It is a beautiful Thursday afternoon, and I have the pleasure today of going downtown to talk to this week's guest, Morgan Wallace. Morgan is a political science major at the University of Arizona, and she's joining me for our second episode on none other than The Great Gatsby by F. Scott Fitzgerald. Morgan definitely has some very unique and compelling insights on this novel, so I'm excited to see what you guys think of the discussion. Hello and welcome back to Didion Hawthorne and the In-Between. I'm your host, Mackenzie Gentz, and you're listening to my podcast about the relevancy of literature in the 21st century. Now bookmark that book, and let's begin. As always, there is a general announcement before we get started. Haruki Murakami is a contemporary Japanese writer, and he has a new book coming out called Killing Commendatory. It will actually already be out for about a month by the time this episode comes out. The book is a tribute to The Great Gatsby, so if you've enjoyed these discussions and would like a good supplementary material, that would definitely be a good book to check out. This week we have a retrospective one-minute summary because Morgan and I forgot to record it when we met to record the episode. Regardless, the one-minute summary is as follows. We stumble in on an ephemeral discourse by none other than narrator Nick, who spills the tea on his bias in order to catch us up on Nickland before we head into the events that happened with Gatsby. Here we learn that Nick has moved to New York after college to sell bonds and is living in a shack on Long Island's West Egg, home to those with a ton of new money, though Nick isn't really included in this figure quite yet. Across the sound is East Egg, home to people who come from old money. We learn that Nick's cousin Daisy lives with her husband Tom and unnamed daughter on East Egg, which is the location for the first luau in the book. At Tom and Daisy's estate, Nick meets beautiful Jordan Baker, a famous golfer, and learns over dinner that Tom has taken a mistress in the city. All the while, he keeps hearing mention of a mysterious figure named Gatsby, who turns out to be his next-door neighbor. More on this later. Next, Tom decides to take Nick to meet his mistress, Myrtle Wilson, who is a boisterous and lively figure married to the unfortunate George Wilson, a car mechanic living in the place fittingly called the Valley of Ashes. They have a small but over-the-top party at Myrtle and Tom's apartment, where minor characters are introduced and Nick gets drunk for what he says is one of only two times in his entire life. Soon afterwards, he is formally invited to one of Gatsby's infamous parties, though when he shows up, it seems that he's the only one with an invitation. At the party, he's introduced to Jay Gatsby, who turns out to have a mysterious relationship with Jordan Baker. The next day, Gatsby takes Nick out to lunch in his amazing yellow car and introduces him to Meyer Wolfsheim, one of his business partners. He tells Nick about his past, including his stint in the war and his time at Oxford, and then asks him for a favor. The nature of the favor he will learn from Jordan over tea. It turns out that all he wants from him is to invite Daisy over for tea, and he learns that Gatsby has been in love with Daisy for a lifetime. Nick agrees and invites Daisy over, who's as quick as Gatsby to make up for lost time and become Gatsby's mistress. She even shows up with Tom to one of Gatsby's parties. At this point, we learn about Gatsby's real history, that he has a rags-to-riches story that included living on a yacht with an old rich guy. Oh yeah, and his real name is actually James Gatz. Nearing the end of the novel, Jordan, Tom, Daisy, Gatsby, and Nick meet up on a hot summer's day and decide to go to town together. They take a hotel room, make some mint juleps, and before long, Gatsby and Tom are in a heated argument. He basically climbs on the elephant in the room and spits in Tom's face, which he does not take lightly. Time for major spoilers, so if you don't want the book ruined, I'd suggest hitting fast forward for about 30 seconds in 3, 2, 1. After the fight, Daisy and Gatsby leave in his car, only to hit Myrtle Wilson on the way back, who dies a bloody death on impact. We find out that she was planning to leave George permanently, though he was doing everything in his power to keep her from doing so. Later that night, Tom and Daisy reconcile, leaving Gatsby in the dark. Literally, he waits outside their house in the dark. The next day, George goes on a killing rampage and shoots Gatsby by the pool. The rest of the novel follows in the wake of Gatsby's funeral and Daisy and Tom's fleeing from town. It ends the same way as it begins, in an ephemeral monologue by none other than Nick. Welcome, Morgan. So I wanted to know about your initial thoughts on the book and what you would tell someone who hasn't read this book before.
I think that my initial thoughts are that it's a really great summary of the Golden Age and the 20s in general. I guess if I was talking to someone who hadn't read the book, I would say just be familiar with that time period because it just plays into that time period and comments on American society so much.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think the last generation is a huge factor in a lot of the themes that we're seeing in this book. It kind of surprises me how he was living in Paris for so long, but he wrote about America almost exclusively.
Yeah.
And so well, too. Okay, well, question one. What is the best way to look at the organization in this novel? We were talking about this a bit before, and there are some things like sequentially chapter by chapter, and other ways each chapter is a party, or you could look at it summatively, which is, I think, how we both look at it.
Yeah, I definitely think that I look at it summatively, and that's the better way to look at it, but I can see how the chapters, each of them being a party, is really interesting.
Right.
I didn't really think of that before, but it's true.
Yeah, I think that some people might need a better approach to this book, and approaching it as every single chapter is just another party is a good way for someone who maybe hasn't gotten into literature before to look at it. But, I mean, summatively, I think champions, because you can look at all of the themes and all of the little nuances all at one time. It's like kind of looking at a finished painting as opposed to looking at the process of the painting. You can only really get a better view by stepping back from it.
And I think that if you look at it progressively or sequentially, there is a clear timetable and plot line going on throughout the book. It does go from one event to another event, but I think that that almost plays more into the fact that each chapter is an event in itself or a party. But the book starts out with a summary too of Nick's life and who Gatsby is, even though he doesn't truly know who he is yet. But it almost starts you off with a let's catch you up moment.
Yeah, and it's all super ephemeral. It's at least written in this ephemeral way that's like, so like, what does this mean? And then it ends the same way, which is really cool. I think we talked about that a bit in the last episode. Question two, if we look at this novel through a cultural lens, so in other words, if we focus on its depiction of American culture, perhaps in relation to other cultures, to what extent does the novel serve as a cultural mirror even today?
Well, I think the obvious answer would be Nick is really just being carried away by what's happening in relation to like where he is versus the events happening. Like in the beginning of the book, he says that his father gave him the advice of being open to everything. So he's never really tried to judge something. He's only tried to go with it
and observe
it. And not to cast judgment. And I feel like that really takes him on a different journey than if he were to. In today's culture, we can feel that way sometimes, that we're not really having our own destiny, that we're just going by each event.
Mm-hmm. Right. And, well, how do you think, this is a supplementary question, I guess, but how reliable do you think?
I would say he's more reliable than a lot of other narrators just because he's not trying to cast judgment. He's not trying to put his own emotions into what's happening. I mean, we can still see that. You can't really have a detached narrator.
But what about like an omniscient narrator?
But in the sense that Nick is narrating.
Yeah.
Like that's what I mean.
Yeah.
Like if you're narrating your own story, like first person, you can't really have an emotional detachment, especially from an emotionally driven character, which I feel Nick is.
Yeah, I also think he does a really good job of admitting his own bias in the beginning of the novel. I wanted to ask also, what connection to consumerism versus minimalism do you think this book has?
I think there's so much consumerism present. I mean, just how this is the time where alcohol is illegal. You're not supposed to be having it. Gatsby made his fortune on bootlegging. Like, I mean, there's just those references that are the overarching themes almost of the book itself. So there is consumerism there.
Yeah, I think everyone in this novel, at least to a certain extent, is aspiring to be like Gatsby and has everything. But then it's interesting, almost ironic, because Gatsby has everything, but then he loses everything.
Well, I think that you could also make the argument that Gatsby has everything, but that what matters to him, which is Daisy. The only thing that he's ever wanted in life is Daisy, so all of the consumer culture that he's bought into is only for Daisy because that's what she wants in a husband and in a lover. So he's done all of that for Daisy. So I think you could make the argument that while he does have all this, it doesn't matter to him.
Mm-hmm.
So is it therefore playing into consumer culture? I would say that he's also aspiring for something that he can't have like most Americans at this time.
Right. And is that true of Americans today?
I think so. I mean, when we select jobs, like again, we're going into college, we have to think about what career we want in the future.
Sure.
I think about what can make me money. How can I live financially stable? Like, I don't need to be rich and own a mansion like Gatsby, but I definitely would like to have some place to live.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I think a lot of it has to do with perceptions and standards and what are your
yes.
own personal standards and what are your own personal perceptions. There's this interesting study. I'll link it in the description, but it's essentially said that the music that you listen to when you're 19 and 20 is the music that most imprints itself into your life in the future. And so I think in a lot of ways, the whole college experience is the same way, where that's the period of years that most imprints itself on your future. And I mean, maybe the same can be said of childhood, but I think really college is the launching point for a lot of adults, especially millennials.
It's that bridge between childhood and adulthood, and it's forming where you're going in life in connection to where you've been before.
Right. So culturally, I mean, this novel has so much to do with especially adulthood and what that means.
I think we can also see it through the advertisements in the book as well, because we have the eyes of God that are watching Nick through the glasses in the billboard.
Dr. T.J. Eckelberg.
Yes.
My favorite. Yeah, I totally agree. There's the fact that almost every character in this book is eventually a loser.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, except perhaps for Nick, which is interesting.
I would say that he lost his best friend, and in a sense, he also sort of lost his cousin Daisy. Like,
yes.
he doesn't really have anyone to turn back to when everything is said and done.
Okay, well, let's move on to question 3. Is the American dream the same as it was in the 20s, or has it molded to fit the time?
I mean, how do you define the American dream in the 20s?
I'd say the American dream in the 20s was very much characterized by the same consumerism that we were just talking about, where you could go from rags to riches by working hard enough and willing it into existence, almost.
I feel like that's what we want now, but that the nihilism of just everyday life, society, the postmodern era, has eaten into the American dream. So while we still aim for that, we're more cynical about it. Like, people back then, I feel like they felt like they could achieve that if they worked hard enough.
Mm-hmm.
And if they just, like, pulled up their bootstraps and got down to it, they could make that money.
Mm-hmm.
But today, we're more aware and cynical of
yeah.
how the world functions. And if you went on the street and like asked everyone, do you think that if you did all this that you could make the money? And I doubt that a lot of people would say yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I think that today is especially characterized by this overwhelm of information. And I always think of the paradox of choice, where on the one hand, if you don't have enough choices, then you can't really make a really good choice. And if there's only one choice, then it's not really a choice. But if there are hundreds of choices, then it's the same thing. You're just as paralyzed about making a choice. And so I think in a lot of ways, we have so many different ideas of the American dream now that, you know, the 20s idea is perhaps one of them. The 50s especially changed the American dream ideas. I just think about like Philip Roth and how his writing kind of compares to a lot of this. And it's just up to every individual to choose. Okay, now the part that you've been waiting for, really. Is there a gay reading of The Great Gatsby or of any book for that matter? What do you think?
Oh, definitely. I think that you can almost take any lens and apply it to almost any piece of art, novel, movie, whatever you want, and you can read into those subliminal messages and you can really draw away whatever you want. I definitely see how there can be a gay argument for this book. I mean, if you just go to the first part where Nick is introduced to Tom, he describes him in a very sensual way almost. And I think in that alone, you can detect how gay that is. And just,
that's so interesting. I didn't actually, now that I think of it.
Oh yeah.
That's definitely not on my radar, the first few reads through. But it does make sense. I mean, he has that luau with Jordan Baker, but I feel like even a detached narrator like Nick would have, you know, had some more profound feelings or things to say about that.
I mean, I think that you can read his relationship with Gatsby in two ways. I think that there's definitely the homosexual way to read it, as in he's in love with Gatsby, or he's in love with him, like the ideal of Gatsby, or he is his best friend, which, I mean, is true.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's really the only person that's ever really cared about Nick. When Nick is introduced, he mentions the family,
mm-hmm.
but in no other part does he really draw upon that family, except for when he's talking about his cousin Daisy, who really doesn't care about him. I would say she almost uses him like she uses everyone else in the book. I would say that his relationship with Jordan was more of a convenience,
mm-hmm.
that she was almost forced upon him by convenience.
Yeah.
Just because she was there and she was Daisy's friend and she needed someone to be in a relationship with, so Nick was there.
Yeah.
They're together now.
Yeah, and of course, I mean, I don't think a lot of this stuff was openly in the radar in the time. I mean,
oh,
of course,
definitely.
Fitzgerald would have experienced some stuff like that, just because of the circles that he was known to frequent, but yeah, definitely not for the general public.
No, it definitely would have had to be camouflaged.
Subversive.
Yes.
Do you know what this reminds me of? Kind of Yuri on Ice. Have you ever seen that?
Yeah,
that's kind of what it reminds me of, where it's like, are they, but is it? And you're like trying to read all things. I mean, I think it's definitely clearer in Yuri on Ice.
Yes.
But yeah, that's kind of what it reminds me of when you're talking.
It's like how to make it clear without actually saying it.
Yeah, exactly. We talked about this last week, but I wanted your input. Do you think there's a Fitzgerald cameo in this book? Like, do you think Gatsby is Fitzgerald's ideal self?
I don't know. That's a hard question.
Yeah, or is it Nick? Is Fitzgerald hiding under the guise of Nick? And therefore, Nick's little ephemeral musings in the beginning and end are also Fitzgerald's musings?
I could see that. But usually when an author inputs themselves in a narrative, they pick the character that's most heroic,
mm-hmm.
because that's how they want themselves to be perceived. Or in some cases, the author really wants themselves to be downgraded and demeaned by the character that they put themselves as.
Yeah, I feel
like neither one is true of any of the characters.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that in the end, Gatsby's death really just reinforces how you can't really ever achieve what you want.
Mm-hmm. So
exactly.
Gatsby's death is kind of the death of the American dream. In many ways. Oh yeah, I was going to say that Kurt Vonnegut in Kilgore Trout, his alter ego. Kilgore Trout is a total loser, and he writes little like sci-fi books that are only sold in porn shops, and it's an allusion to the fact that Kurt Vonnegut could only get published in Playboy for a while.
Yeah, I don't see anything that upfront about Fitzgerald putting himself in this work, but I can see how people could make an argument for it.
Mm. So do you think that Nick or Gatsby is more of a cameo, or do you think they're kind of equally a cameo?
I would say that Nick would be more of a cameo, just because I feel like Gatsby really represents the American dream, not an entity in itself. I feel like Nick, though, is the typical American during this time.
Of course.
Going around just... But at the same time, he doesn't have any ambitions in life. So it's tough.
Nick doesn't have any true ambitions. He has kind of these surface ambitions. Like, people tell him he should be successful at selling stocks.
He has ambitions by proxy.
Yeah, exactly. Which is so weird. I don't think that's... I'm referring to question three again. I think that definitely that's something that has changed today, is that we have actual ambitions, and it's okay to pursue music and art. All right. Anything else to say about the book?
No. I think we've covered most of it.
Okay. Well, I want to get into weekly favorites. I have a favorite real quick to insert. I just got the book Simple Matters by Jenny Mustard in the mail. I ordered this book in May, so I've been waiting for it for a very long time, and it did not disappoint. I love every single photograph in that book. I love she includes a lot of different essays and recipes and stuff like that. And if you guys don't know, Jenny Mustard is a YouTuber and podcaster and Instagrammer. She mostly does like minimalist photos, veganism, stuff like that. that. Great, great book if you guys want to check that out.
Do you have a weekly favorite?
I think my weekly favorite would be my Intro to Oceanography class. I am not a science person as per my political science major, but I'm really enjoying this class. I've learned about so many new things that I would never have thought to even think about before. So I guess it's just an eye-opening experience and a lot of fun. I love my professor as well. Take classes from teachers you love.
Yeah, totally.
I would say that one of the works that really compares to The Great Gatsby is Midnight in Paris, which is really good. I'm going to go rewatch that now that we've talked about this. We were talking about it a little bit before. It's such a good movie. It has a lot of art. It has a lot of the same parallels of what the book is. And, of course, then it has Fitzgerald himself Tom Hiddleston.
I love Tom Hiddleston. Yeah, and okay, my related reading, I wanted to give different books and stuff. I did a lot of the about the Last Generation last time. So this time I'm going to do outside books that are still kind of related. This is a book called Human Voices by Penelope Fitzgerald. She's a British writer, and I don't think they're related in any way. But she actually started writing when I think she was in her 60s and has since written 20 novels and has gotten Britain's highest book awards. So I think her story is really cool, and she writes a lot about her experiences in the BBC during World War II. There's also a book called Saving the Waltz. It's by his wife, Zelda Fitzgerald. It's the one and only book that she ever wrote. She wrote it in a period of 3 months when she was having her worst mental collapse of all time. I'm not sure if she was institutionalized at this point or what, but it was definitely in that time period. Although she did write some of the passages from his other books, including The Great Gatsby. And then also poems by T.S. Eliot and Ezra Pound. Those are both great poets to check out. Okay, well, I think that about wraps it up. Any final words?
Goodbye.
Bye.
If you enjoyed the discussion and would like to hear more from me, consider checking out the last episode where I discuss 8 books that will change your perspective forever. Everything DH and I can be found at didianandhawthorne.blueberry.net, except blueberry is spelled B-L-U-B-R-R-Y. Also, stay tuned for the next episode in 2 weeks' time. We'll have another special guest and we'll be chatting about all things Tolstoy. Now you can also follow the show on Twitter and join our Twitter campaign about last month's horrifying classics. We can be found at @DidianIn, and we'll be posting about new lit releases, reading lists, and of course the new projects and episodes relating to DH and I. Still there? One more thing then. Remember that leaving a comment or review on iTunes, Spotify, or any other Guilty Pleasure podcast platform helps leverage the show so that other literature enthusiasts can find the community. In other words, it helps a ton. See you in 2 weeks. Auf Wiedersehen! According to Hallmark, it's nearing December, and time already to share the next big project on DH&I. That's right, starting in December, I will be releasing Saturday 12-minute bonus episodes on novels by Charles Dickens. I'm calling it December Dickens. Happy early holidays!